The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. The first month of your membership is only 99 cents. Sign up today at Gaia.com/Jim. That's GAIA.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com. For a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial, go to Audible.com/paranormal. That's Audible.com/paranormal. Thanks, Audible.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold, and I'm so glad to be with you today. Boy, do we have a red letter day here at the Paranormal Podcast. We have three great guests. First up, we have Amy Bruni and Adam Berry. Of course, you know them from ghost hunting fame on television, and they have a new show called Kindred Spirits, and we're going to talk all about it. Then we've got Colin Dickey with a major book that's out, a top seller. It's called Ghostland. So I will not delay any further. Let's get to the paranormal goodness. I hope you're having a great Halloween season, and here's the show. Our guests today, very exciting, two big TV stars, and they have a new show coming up. It's called Kindred Spirits. It's going to be on TLC, and I'm talking about world-renowned ghost hunters Amy Bruni and Adam Berry. Of course, you know them formerly from Ghost Hunters, but now they are doing a new show in a new way, and we're going to talk about it. It actually premieres Friday, October 21st. At 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. So very exciting new show on TLC. Amy and Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks Hi. For having us.
So what is different? What's going to be different from this show from all of the others that we've seen out there on television?
Well, I think that the first thing is people are going to get a very in-depth look of how a paranormal investigation goes. I think that we take the viewer with us from start to finish. There's a resolution at the end of every episode. So, they're very emotional cases. They're very in-depth cases. There's a lot of research. There's a lot of interviews with family members, witnesses, and so we take you from start to finish. There's always, it's like a mystery. And then at the end, we kind of find out our answers and we try to, bring some relief to these families.
Yeah, it's a lot more heartfelt, if you will. It's very in-depth, like Amy was saying. And there's a lot more, compassion for the homeowners and for the actual spirits that we're looking for. And they're all family cases. There's not a museum in sight.
Now, you guys as a team, talk about how and why you guys paired up for this show and how your styles contrast and complement each other.
Adam and I met obviously on Ghost Hunters, and it was fate, I think. We were incredibly close. We're like family at this point. And we learned pretty quickly that our investigative styles were, there's just something about us together. I think it's just we're people describe us as kind of the most cheerful ghost hunters you'll ever meet. and so I think that works for us, right, Adam?
Yeah, no, I do too. I mean, I think we have similar styles. I think, we play off each other very well. We kind of know at this point what each other are thinking. And it's funny because, we don't want to scare the client, but there are times we're investigating or doing something and the client is with us and we have a secret code word that we have to say to each other so that we can step away from the client and discuss the things that we want to talk about without freaking them out. Like, so we get along really well. And I think, what's great about this show is, we left Ghost Hunters in different reasons. Amy has a family. I run a theater company. And the schedule was really, really tough. And it was kind of grueling to be away from home all the time. And so we decided, what would be the thing that we'd want to do if we ever got the chance to do it again, and you know, what hasn't been seen yet on television, and really Kindred Spirits is it. You know, it's something that we are very passionate about. It's something that we wanted to do, and something we found ourselves trying to do on Ghost Hunters, but just did not have the capabilities or really the time to do more in-depth research and really connect with the clients on an emotional level.
When you talk about in-depth, kind of put us through some of the differences that we will see as opposed to, I'm not just saying Ghost Hunters, but all of the other, the similar shows out there, the paranormal investigation shows. What makes your investigations for Kindred Spirits different?
Well, first of all, I mean, we investigate 3 or 4 nights in a row. So we go back, we'll investigate one night and get some evidence. And then the next day we'll go research. We'll go to the Historical Society. We'll go digging through deeds. We'll start interviewing people. We'll look up newspaper, you know, articles. We'll try to, you know, any evidence that we get, we'll use that to kind of fuel our research and then go back in the next night and investigate using what we found out during the day, during our research and our interviews. And it's just this, we basically live at the house. These poor families have to put up with us for, you know, 4 or 5 days in a row. And it's really the way a paranormal investigation should be done. It becomes more of a case study versus just a, hey, we're here for the night and this is what we found. And yep, your house is haunted, or nope, it's not. Bye. You know, it's just, we provide, you know, we'll never claim to cross something over or anything, but we do give them an answer as to why we think whatever is there is there. These are families that think that they're being haunted by loved ones and family members. And so they have an incredible emotional connection to these ghosts that are in their home. And so there's just so much on the line emotionally. It almost feels like, you know, like a psychic type show, but without the psychic. Like, we're, you know what I mean? It's that right. Emotional at right. The end. There's a lot of tears. There's a lot of laughter. It's so real, and we feel like they're our family by the time we leave.
Yeah, I would also say it's sort of like we are real true investigators. It's like we are private eyes. We literally, like Amy said, talk to everyone that we possibly can get our hands on that might be connected to, you know, some of the activity or might know something about the house or the land, and it's like being part of the FBI, but for ghosts. So it's really, really, really in depth. And I think, one of the major, I lost my train of thought. Of course I did. Cause it's like early, not really early, but like,
it's not early for Adam Berry.
It's early for me.
it's almost noon, but no big deal.
Hey, listen, no big deal, you guys.
You see a little bit of the interplay there.
I mean, I was going to say, you know, it's, whatever, it's a lot more in depth. And I think, it's a lot of fun, and, it is very different than what you would say. Oh yes. Got it. Figured it out. Because Amy and I are executive producers on the show, we control the content. So if, for instance, one day or one, you know, we go through some research and we find out X, Y, and Z is happening, we find a family member that we need to talk to. We will go and find them. We will go and get them. If we need someone to help us with something because we've discovered a new piece to the puzzle, but we need an expert to tell us what that means, we can get that. Like, nothing really stifles our journey for the solution. We can do anything we want to do. And I think that is the biggest thing that changes between us and Ghost Hunters and what we were doing on Ghost Hunters and what we're doing now. And also, you know, it's another paranormal show. It's its own beast, and it changes on a daily basis. We had no idea what was going to happen the next day. We literally just did what we had to do, and it changed on its own, and we found a solution because we were really, really investigating what was going on.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I used to never understand why actors or creative people wanted to have control. I'm like, they just want to do everything. But it really is, having gotten into even doing these podcasts and occasionally being and I'm not speaking to any previous show you were on. I'm just talking about in general. But even myself, having been approached a few times about from different TV companies and things like that, production companies and so forth, it really is important to have control, as much control as you can, because that's your name on it. It's your reputation on the line. So I think that it's really refreshing when you hear that the actual investigators have, you know, some strong control of the direction of the program. I think that really makes a difference. Is that your experience?
Well, that was really the deciding factor for us to even come back to TV, because we knew we wanted, you know, as much as we love doing Ghost Hunters, you know, it was hard for us. We wouldn't know how they were going to portray what we experienced until the episode aired. That was the first time we saw the episode. And so it's been really nice with Kindred Spirits. They send us the rough cuts and we go through and we make notes and send them back. And it just, it ensures that we are, you know, that the story that happened, you know, the story you see is how it happened. And, you know, nothing is misrepresented. And it also gives a really good example for other paranormal investigators, you know, as to how to run an investigation. I mean, as much as you can in 43 minutes of footage or whatever, you know, it's hard to fit that much into that time frame. But it's important for our field. You know, we take what we do very seriously. And for that to be put on TV in front of millions of people, you know, you don't want to get it wrong. I mean, I'm sure people will find things wrong with it, but that's, we've done it to the best of our ability.
Right, exactly.
Now, one thing I'm always curious about with these types of the show is the use of technology, because it's really, to me, it's fascinating, the idea that you can hold an instrument and maybe possibly detect paranormal activity. On the other hand, sometimes it, to me, is a little overdone and maybe a little hyped on some programs. How do you both view the technology, and how and do you use it in Kindred Spirits?
Well, you'll see, we use technology, but we really like to connect to the entities on a more emotional level. So we don't want to be fiddling with all this crazy equipment, especially things that might intimidate them. So we use this kind of back to basics feel, but we are using a lot of current, you know, paranormal technology at the same time. But, you know, we're much more into the kind of set it and forget it methodology, where we like equipment that we can set down and set somewhere and walk away from it and continue our investigation talking to these things with nothing crazy in our hands. Or, you know, we just want to connect with them on a personal level.
Yeah, I think we use equipment more as verification and backup. Like, yes, this thing is interacting with this piece of equipment. Okay, we're going in the right direction. Rather than, you know, those big machines that are, like, not big machines, but that equipment that you have to set out and it takes forever to set it up. And then, you know, you sit and you're always focused and lost in this wormhole of equipment where you're just looking at the equipment and you miss everything around you. And that's not what we're into at all.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. The new show is called, the new series is called Kindred Spirits. It's going to premiere Friday, October 21st at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. And we're with the stars of the show, Amy Bruni and Adam Berry. And we're going to talk about it more right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible has been such a great supporter over the years of all of our programs, and we'd like to thank them for supporting this program today. And we're going to tell you how you can get a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial. Now, if you've heard about Audible for all these years and you've delayed, don't delay any longer, because Audible has gone from strength to strength and only has gotten better. And obviously, you're listening to this show, so you love audio entertainment. And Audible has an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original shows, news, comedy, and more. I love audiobooks because you can transform your life. You can get great entertainment, great information, and you can transform maybe tasks you don't enjoy that much into something that's really, it's a delight. For example, commuting, maybe doing chores around the house, maybe doing your landscaping, and not too far for the future for those of us in the northern climates, shoveling snow. So whatever it might be, working out, it can make maybe the mundane a lot more fun. Now, for our audience, Audible is offering a free audiobook with a 30-day trial. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. So just go to audible.com/paranormal and browse their unmatched selection of audio content. Download a free title and start listening. It's that easy. And actually, one audiobook you may want to consider is our guest in the second part of the program today, which we'll hear shortly, Colin Dickey and his new book, Ghostland. And I think once you hear the interview, you'll know that it's something that you'll really like. And guess what? You can get Ghostland or another audiobook of your choice for free with a 30-day free trial at audible.com/paranormal. That's audible.com/paranormal. Thanks to Audible for supporting our podcast for these many years. Get your free audiobook with a 30-day free trial at audible.com/paranormal. Thanks, Audible. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guests are the stars of the all-new television series Kindred Spirits, premiering on TLC Friday, October 21st at 10 Eastern, 9 Central. I'm talking about Amy Bruni and Adam Berry. Now, Amy and Adam, particularly on this show, you're really looking into these ghosts that are kindred spirits. They're typically family members and so forth. Why? What are the reasons, in your view, that spirits haunt families? Why do they come here? What are they trying to accomplish? Or is it vary depending on the situation?
I would say it definitely varies. Our experience has been that many times there really is something to the unfinished business theory. Many times there were just things left unsaid. A lot of our kindred spirits families were people who didn't get a chance to kind of say the last thing they wanted to, or maybe someone passed away and they were fighting at the time. And so you'll see it's, that happens in a lot of cases. And then there's definitely other situations as well. Right, Adam?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest thing that we learned is, families have an idea of who they think it is because they are around the activity 24/7. But they may be surprised to find out what it actually is, or if it's that and something else. And I think it's differentiating between, what activity is grandma and what activity is maybe a previous landowner from the 1700s, and they would never know that. But because we can do research and find names and interview people and talk to historians, we're able to gather enough ammunition to find out exactly who it is and what they might need. And for the reasons why people are around, I mean, it could be anything. They just want, maybe they want acknowledgement. Maybe they have a message. Maybe they are just checking on their property. Maybe they like the fact that you have a lot of kids and, they like being around children. And so there's a many different possibilities, I think. And I don't necessarily think we figured out 100% as to, a formula for why someone wants to stay, but everyone has their own, different reasons. I would say.
Now, you had mentioned about doing the research and going back and talking to historians and looking at the history of the place, whether it's the last 20 or 30 years, or if we're talking 300 years ago or 250 years ago. How can you tie, let's say, the historical background of a place, of a home, to a specific person? I mean, how that would seem like a tough connection to make. How do you know it's, instead of Aunt Millie, it's Uncle Jehoshaphat? I mean, how do you do that?
Well,
evidence. It's a combination between evidence and reactions to names and confirmation that we're on the right track with evidence, and it's backing up what we're saying and what we're doing. Right? I mean, we find a lot of things that we. Go ahead.
No, I mean, they'll literally tell us their names, or we've brought in sketch artists before to have like kids describe, entities they've seen, or we take the information that we have and investigate using it and wait for responses. I mean, it's crazy. It's also crazy how many times we've dug up things that just nobody even had any idea or associated with the mm-hmm. land. So it's, that's why we go back again and again. It's because we look for those correlations. We look for those crossovers to happen. And that's when we know we're onto something.
Seems to me you could have families who are maybe pleased with what you learn, and maybe other people were hoping it was Aunt Millie and it wasn't, and maybe they're not as pleased. But I guess the goal in the end is getting to the truth, not necessarily telling somebody what they want to hear.
Exactly.
Yeah, and we always ask them, like, what are you going to do if it's not what you think? And, you'll see their reactions when you watch. It's interesting.
it's a tough thing, because a lot of, families are emotional. And if they think it's someone and they have unfinished business with the person that it's passed, and, they hope it's them. And, if it turns out not to be, it's a hard thing, but we have to tell them. I mean, we're not going to play into their fears, and we're not going to play into their hopes, because our job is to tell them what we think based on, what we've known in the past through investigating, and what we know now, and evidence and logic, and ruling out things that don't make any sense. And it's tough, but it's in the end, I mean, I think all of those families definitely benefited from our advice and from what we found, I think.
Now, I've got to believe that when we talk about family hauntings, most of the time we would like to think that this is for reassurement or because you want to be close to someone that you loved and those kind of things, if you're haunting a family and so forth. Are there ever others, though? I'm sure there's plenty of those heartwarming stories. Is there ever a time when maybe a family member is haunting because they're PO'd and they kind of do it out of spite? Does that ever happen?
Yeah. I mean, we can't say specifics, but yes, it has been known to happen. And occasionally it's just someone else who's PO'd. So you have to, especially with these cases, every one of them, it's like a story. It's like it's crazy to watch it all come together. But yes, that does happen. Grudges don't stop because someone passes away.
Exactly. It's funny because Amy likes to say, and it's true, it's like if you were a jerk in your life, you might be a jerk when you're dead. So it doesn't necessarily need to be a demon. It could just be a person who's a jerk treating you, like a jerk, and he's dead. And so it's like people can hold grudges and they can tell you that they think X, Y, and Z, and that they don't like certain things that you're doing to the house. And that's why, people find activity escalating when they renovate. If they have ghosts in their house, because they're like, wait a minute, you're changing my house, and they get pissed off and they hold grudges. And, we're dealing with intelligent spirits, and they can communicate and talk. And, that's really the coolest thing, actually.
Do the spirits sometimes have a sense of humor?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the ghost. Those the same, route of the grumpy ghost. Sometimes they're silly ghosts, the mischievous ghosts. Their personality is very true. And that's how many of our families knew who we were dealing with was who they thought it was or wasn't. The personality just matched or didn't match who we were looking for. And so it's always really important to whatever activity you're getting, try to figure out kind of the why. Like, is this something that's trying to get my attention, or is this something that's trying to scare me, or is this something that's trying to mess with me, because that they do. They all have different personalities.
Yeah. I mean, and you can tell, and it's so cool because, we'll have a piece of evidence that we sounds like a person, we think we know what they're saying, but we don't know. We don't know who it is. So maybe we'll play it for a family member that was very familiar with their voice. And they're like, oh my God, that's so-and-so, because that's their laugh, or like, that's their tone of their voice, or that's, you know, they're messing with you, and or they like to move. He was very mischievous in life, and so he moves things around the house. I mean, there's really cool things that add up, really, that correlate to family members and really pinpoint that we know who we're talking to.
Is there anything, as you've go along, done this, you've done the previous shows, you do this new show, do you still get surprised despite how many times you go out and investigate?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
That's all right.
I cut out for a second.
That's all right, not a problem. You guys have done this for a long time. And you've been on many, many investigations for the previous shows and now this new show. Are you ever surprised by what you find?
Oh, always. Gosh, yes. Yeah, especially with kindred spirits. I think it was because when we were doing these cases, there was so much on the line. You know, it was very different from, you know, I've obviously, and Adam too, we both investigated long before we were even on television. And I feel like when I first started investigating, I did a lot of home cases like this. And this was great to kind of go back to that. And it's amazing sometimes. What's amazing about crazy experiences in a house is that you think, oh my gosh, this family's living with this every day. This piece of activity, you know, this evidence that surprises me, someone who's been doing this for, you know, a long time without giving away my age. they live with this, and that is crazy what some of these people deal with on a day-to-day basis, things that still, you know, make me kind of freak out, make all the hair on the back of my neck stand up, you know? So yeah, we do get surprised.
And I'd say, what's surprising for Kindred Spirits, I mean, we are trying to put together, I use it all the time, but like we're putting together a puzzle, right? And, you know, when the puzzle's complete, maybe we've got the answer. And so there are times when we don't know where this piece is. We have no idea where it is. We don't know what we're going to do. And when we stumble across it, it shocks us. Because finally, after going through the research and digging even deeper and like keep moving forward and looking, and we find something that fits the puzzle, it's awesome. And that stuff is great because we're not talking about, I mean, ghosts. And at that point, we're talking about actual evidence and facts and figures that correlate to the activity or to what's happening in the house. And that is always shocking and amazing to us.
Yeah, now, obviously, you hope for the show to be popular and do well. I think anybody who does anything commercially wants it to be a success. But aside from kind of the commercial goals of it, what are your goals for the show?
I think humanity back to ghost hunting. I actually, Grant Wilson is one of my best friends, and we were talking about this the other night about how even just our message as we go and lecture and everything, we always just try to kind of drive home to people that these ghosts that you're dealing with, they're people just like you and me. And that, and then you have these families when, as a paranormal investigator, when a family invites you into their home because they're desperate and they're scared, you know, it's not a game at that point. It's not a hobby at that point. It's something that you need to take very, very seriously. And so I think that with Kindred Spirits, we're hoping to kind of dial it back a little bit from kind of the glorifying of ghost hunting and, oh, it's so scary. And, oh, we're going to go, you know, in this big freaky asylum. And, you know, this is just kind of bringing it back home and showing people just how this all started and what it really means to be a paranormal investigator.
Adam?
Yeah. And I think, I think what's really cool about our show is it's more accessible. I mean, we are in families' homes. This can happen to you. This can happen to anyone. I mean, people sometimes say, I mean, if you ask a group of people in a lecture and you say, how many people have had paranormal activity in their home? 80% of those people will raise their hands. I mean, this is a real thing that happens to people, and it's very accessible. And what we're doing in the steps that we're telling, you know, the clients to take to, you know, deal with certain things, people at home can actually benefit from that and they can learn from that. And I think that's a major plus for what, you know, what we're doing. And, you know, when we said that we wanted to do, if we wanted to go back to television, what we wanted to do, and it's really documenting and showing the general public that may not know that there is a lot involved when you investigate. Some people may only know their relationship to ghost hunting is ghost hunters or ghost adventures, or, you know, that they may watch these shows and that's their only connection to what we do, but there's more to it, you know. And I'm not saying that those two shows, they don't do it research, because we did research on ghost hunters, but it's showing the complete package and showing people that, yeah, there's a lot more to it. I mean, I did an interview yesterday and I was telling the interviewer all the stuff that we were doing, and she was like, oh, so you take this seriously? And I'm like, yes, what do you mean? What do you mean? Like, yes, of course we take this seriously. This is huge. These stakes are huge. We are talking about people's emotions and what they're feeling, and we cannot be wrong. We have to be as strong in our commitment to what we think is happening in that house so that we can give them an answer, because usually we're their last resort at this point. And I think that is the biggest thing that Kindred Spirits is going to show the general public that no other TV show has shown. And it's something that we are proud of, because that is what we wanted to do when we got back into putting it on television. The only reason why I want to put it on television is so that people can actually learn what really goes on. And it's not just going into a dark place, wearing all black and not smiling in photographs. It's like, let's figure out what's happening, you know, and let's be friendly and let's be normal people and have a really great time. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with wearing black and not smiling in photographs. We've done it many times.
we spent 7 years doing it.
It's kind of like a paranormal
there's
scowl.
There's nothing wrong with that.
It's the paranormal
we just
scowl.
To change it up a little bit.
So I'll ask you two questions. First of all, okay, I'm a person who thinks that I may have some kind of haunting in my home. Maybe I think it is Aunt Millie. What do I do?
Well, I mean, are you scared or are you, fine with her being
okay,
there?
Well, if we're doing a role play, I'll just say I'm confused. I think something's going on. I'm not particularly scared. I'm not particularly excited, but I think something's going on and I want to get to the bottom of it.
I mean, just someone who's living with it, I mean, I would say if you're really curious about it, try an EVP session. Mm-hmm. That's always the first thing we recommend, just because everyone has a cell phone that records voice memos or something. You know, start with that and see if you get any responses.
Right.
If you think something is there, talk to it. Ask it, who is it? Why are you doing this? Are you trying to scare me? Is there something I could do for you? Or just tell them, I don't really want you doing this. You can just talk to them like a human being. Just talk to them like you would talk to anybody else who's just hanging out in your house that you don't really know. but that's
right.
Kind of the starting point. I mean, we, like with Kindred Spirits, we really deal with people who were, having terrifying activity and they were freaked out. Like that was our first, those are the people we wanted to help. But we did meet and talk to a lot of people who are kind of in the scenario you're describing. We're like, well, weird stuff happens and it's not really scary, but it kind of is weird and I'd like to know who it is, but it's. And anybody can investigate at that level, just kind of, and then you could even start doing research on your home, make it a hobby,
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people who say, for instance, my Aunt Millie is here, right? They already know that it's her and you can't tell them otherwise. I mean, you can help them, guide them, and you can tell them that you don't think that she's there, but it's one of those family connections where you just know it's them because they do X, Y, and Z. And it's sort of this weird feeling. And I would say if you were coming to me and you said, I know my Aunt Millie is in this house, I'd be like, okay. Because you would know better than I do at some time. Especially if you're not afraid. If you're not afraid and you're like, my Aunt Millie is here, I'd be like, cool. Talk to Aunt Millie. Like, hang out with her. But if you were like, I think it's my Aunt Millie and I'm terrified because I wake up with scratches and I don't know why my Aunt Millie is scratching me in the face, then I'd be like, all right, so then let's really figure out if Aunt Millie's stuff at you. I mean, that's a whole different can of worms.
Now let's take it on the other side. Let's say that I've watched all the shows you were on before and you can plan on watching this new show. I'm fascinated by this stuff. I want to go out and investigate. You can hardly hold me back. What would you tell that person who's looking to become a burgeoning ghost investigator?
Well, I mean, we get a lot of people who've seen the TV shows and they want to jump right in and start investigating. But it's really important to, first of all, do your reading on what paranormal investigation is, where it came from. So do research in that respect. You know, figure out what you want to do. Do you want, is this just like a kind of an adrenaline rush for you? Because then maybe you could just start signing up for some, like, you know, investigations at public places like Waverly Hills or, you know, something like that. Or is it something where you really want to help people? Because that kind of, they're two different things. And so some people, they just want to get all the crazy gear and they want to go into these very well-known haunts and get awesome evidence. And that's totally fine. Other people really want to do kind of along the lines of what we're doing and go into homes. And so that kind of determines what path to take. But either way, it's a lot of reading. It's a lot of research. It's a lot of, you know, talking to other people in the field. I strongly recommend going to, you know, paranormal conferences and meeting other like-minded people and seeing where they're at, talking to local teams, seeing if you could shadow them on an investigation or two, see if it's something you really want to do, because TV obviously is edited heavily. There's a lot of sitting in the dark, being very bored. So there's a lot of steps to take for sure.
Well, I would say also don't watch television and then mimic what you see and then be like, I know what I'm doing, because that's not true at all. Like, talk to people, go to cons, go to like paranormal conventions and talk to researchers and pick their brain and learn as much as you can. And then even still, don't think you know everything, because we admit we don't know everything. Sometimes we need to call in an expert and figure out, you know, well, what is your opinion about this? Because we have ideas, but since you study it and you're the expert in this category, you tell us what you think. And it's like, you know, learn from people who know more than you and never stop learning.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that this does happen with this, that people watch the shows. And I'm the first one to say, I am not a paranormal investigator. I just interview them. It's kind of like I'm like a sportscaster. You know, I don't go and suit up and play football. I just interview people who do these sorts of things or write books or who are experts and so forth. And maybe I picked up a little by osmosis, but for the most part, I would never try to go into a place and investigate or anything like that. I do think there is this phenomena where people watch a TV show and they think that, oh, I am an expert. And what's interesting about that, they wouldn't watch a doctor show and think that they could go do brain surgery necessarily. But I think for some reason, and I'm not, you know, no offense, I'm not equating brain surgery to paranormal investigation, but still it's the same concept that sometimes people don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that paranormal investigation gets oversimplified quite often, especially by people who don't do it. You know, it seems so easy. What, you just go walk around the dark and ask questions? But there is so much more to it, and it isn't easy. And, it is easy to go in into the dark and just ask questions, but the legwork behind it and the equipment you use and the know-how and the technology and the science and the psychology, like all the things that you really should draw upon as a paranormal investigator, that just doesn't happen from watching a TV show. And that's really important for people to realize. And like Adam said, we're never afraid to call people in, even us. And you'll see that on the show. You know, we oftentimes would call people in who we thought would be better suited to answer the questions that we needed answered. We're not afraid to be like, oh, we don't know, let's call somebody.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just because I'm on reality TV doesn't mean I can run for president. So
Are you sure about that?
At this rate, you might.
I mean, I'm really good at it. I totally could win. No, but it's the same concept. It's like you hit it right on the nail on the head. It's like you just don't run out and do something because you've seen it. You know, that's why they put disclaimers at the beginning of like that TV show Jackass. They'd be like, do not try this at home. Like close or on car commercials, like close test track. Do not attempt this. Even if you own the car, it's like, you can't do this, guys.
right, exactly. Well, but what folks can do is they can tune into the new series, Kindred Spirits, set to premiere on TLC. Tell us about when and where and all of that good stuff.
Oh my goodness.
October 21st. It's coming fast. October 21st, 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Yeah. That's the premiere, Friday night.
Yeah,
Friday
it's
night
the
haunt.
Premiere. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. And they're also, you're going to see it again on DA, but maybe the beginning of next year, probably. I don't know. I'm going to show it again.
I mean, it's
Destination America.
Yeah, and I was going to say, just the TLC, they have like that full Friday night now. I guess that's going to be their like paranormal night. And mm-hmm. so they have a premiere of A Haunting before us and then us. And then even before that, they have like a special that kind of revisits the whole Ghosts of Shepherdstown story that was right. on Destination America. So it's like a full 3 hours of paranormal programming, which is perfect for fall. It's going to be awesome. I mean, it doesn't get better than
that. Yeah, and there's 8 episodes. So it's going to carry everyone's paranormal bug will be bit all the way through December. So that's pretty awesome. And I think our show is perfect for that because it is scary. It has scary moments. But it's also, you know, something that you can sit down if you're if you have a family and you all like gather around the television and watch paranormal TV shows together. And this is perfect for you because it does have some scary moments, but it's also you know, heartwarming and lighthearted at times. And, you know, you get to see us being us, which is great. They show more of our personality.
Excellent.
That's
well,
true.
Well, I'd like to thank you both for joining us, Amy Bruni and Adam Berry, and the best of luck with Kindred Spirits.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I really enjoyed that. It was great to catch up with Amy and Adam and find out all about this new show, Kindred Spirits. I think that they're really excited about it. I think that legitimately comes through, and I'm sure it's going to be a great program. And our great program is not finished yet because after this very special message, we're going to talk to Colin Dickey about Ghostland. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. You know, I like to think that you can find some of the best audio information on the supernatural and metaphysical right here on our podcast. But where do you turn if you want great video documentaries and programs on the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, the unexplained, and more? Well, it's certainly not the mainstream channels you'll find on your cable service, but there is one answer, thankfully, and it is Gaia. Now, I had the privilege to be on George Norrie's show, Beyond Belief, which is a Gaia program, back in the spring, and it opened my eyes to this tremendous network solely dedicated to the topics we talk about here, seeking truth. I immediately signed up to become a paying member, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Now, you know those big movie streaming services that are all the rage? Well, Gaia is like that, but specifically for people just like us and the topics we love. You can explore life's biggest mysteries from specialists in metaphysics, ancient wisdom, the unexplained, on Gaia's exclusive programs. And you'll find hosts like David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, and of course, George Norrie. Now, the topics you'll find on Gaia are engrossing, and they have a lot of everything. It's a treasure trove. Metaphysics, ancient origins, secrets and cover-ups, the unexplained, it's all there. And the best thing is it's so easy to access because you can find Gaia on all of your streaming devices. So the wisdom, information, and entertainment couldn't be easier to access. You'll find Gaia apps on Android, iOS, Apple TV, Chromecast, Roku, and on the web, among many others. Basically, if you're listening to me right now, you can easily tune in to Gaia. And best of all, it's a great time to join. Your first month of membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. So to mine the wisdom, be entertained and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim to sign up for your first month. Only 99 cents. Heck, you probably have that in your seat cushion, so don't delay. And the thing I really love about this is the fact that with the internet and streaming TV and all these different things, now we can seek out the information that we want. We don't have to wait to be fed by the corporate overlords, you know, these kind of watered down things. You can really get into the material. And for video, there is no place better than Gaia.com. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. Go to Gaia.com/Jim. To get your first month for only 99 cents. Thanks, Gaia. Our guest today has written a different kind of book on ghosts. I think it delves a little deeper and is a different take. Kind of, Men's Journal said it's, Dr. Dickey is one of the sharpest and most erudite writers around, and his new book makes for a perfect Halloween read. And our guest today is Colin Dickey. He is the author of the new number one bestseller in spiritualism, Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. And we're so glad to have him with us now. He comes by this very honestly. He grew up in San Jose, California, a few miles from the Winchester Mystery House, the most haunted house in America. As a writer, speaker, and academic, he has made a career out of collecting unusual objects and hidden histories all over the country. He's a regular contributor to the LA Review of Books and is co-editor of the Morbid Anatomy Anthology. He's also a member of the Order of the Good Death, a collective of artists, writers, and deaf industry professionals interested in improving the Western world's relationship with mortality. And we need that. With a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Southern California, he's an associate professor of creative writing at National University. Colin Dickey, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. This is a different kind of book. How does this maybe differ from some of the other ghostly books that we'll find out there?
It differs a little bit, I guess, in the sense that what I was really interested in doing with this book is really getting behind the stories of some of these haunted places. I sort of described it as a kind of cultural history of the United States told through ghost stories and haunted places. So I sort of set out to go to some of the most, quote unquote, most haunted houses, hotels, cemeteries, cities, etc., and sort of learn about the ghost stories that were told and interview some paranormal investigators and some historians and then sort of see if I could figure out where the truth lies, so to speak, with some of these stories and what might be behind why we tell some stories rather than others, why some places become more haunted than others, and what do those places and those stories say about how we as a culture, both, you know, locally and nationally, feel about our past and the unexplained things all around us.
Why are Americans so fascinated with everything ghostly? Now, I mean, obviously this goes back a long time. You could look at the spiritualism movement, late 1800s, early 1900s, and so forth, but certainly persistent, bigger than ever. Today, as we record this about 3 weeks before Halloween, I mean, the amount of money that Americans will spend to celebrate Halloween is just skyrocketing every year. It's getting bigger and bigger. Why are Americans so fascinated in this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly a question I really wanted to get at, and I came at, you know, probably a constellation of a couple of different reasons for that. I don't think there's one single straightforward reason, but I think a lot of it has to do there are a couple of reasons that maybe sort of account for a lot of it. I think for one thing, you know, we have a fraught relationship with death and mortality, with the loss of our loved ones. And ghosts are one, you know, talking about ghosts, believing in ghosts, having that relationship to the afterlife is one way that we kind of massage or assuage that relationship. I think that's one thing. I think another thing that I kept coming back to, though, is we are surrounded by these weird and old buildings of various kinds that we don't always know their history. I mean, you know, everybody grew up with the weird house that was on the end of the street, right, or maybe right, a couple blocks away. And, you know, you didn't know exactly what was going on with that house. You didn't know what, you know, why was it built that way? Why is it in such disrepair? Who lives there? Who's lived there in the past? You know, all sorts of questions that you're never going to get in a history book. You're never going to learn about on Google. Like, unless you happen to know the old neighbor who's lived there for 80 years and knows all the good stories and gets them to talk, you're going to pass this house again and again and wonder. And I think, you know, a lot of that is where ghost stories come from, and we start to tell stories about these strange or anomalous buildings that we don't have any other means to access.
I mean, someone such as yourself, an academe, obviously very accomplished, but you're taken by weird stuff. For example, as I read earlier, co-editor of the Morbid Anatomy Anthology. So, I mean, how do you think that you personally got interested in all this cornucopia of weirdness?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as you mentioned before, I grew up next to the Winchester Mystery House, which some of your listeners may know is in San Jose, California, and it is this gargantuan, sprawling, 160-room Victorian house that feels more like a labyrinth than it does like a house. It just sprawls off in every direction. It has no overarching plan, and the story behind the house is supposedly that the woman who built it, Sarah Winchester, her father-in-law founded the Winchester Rifle Company, and that she became convinced after her husband and infant daughter died that she was being pursued by all of the ghosts that had been killed by Winchester rifles, and built this house as a labyrinth to keep them out. And you know, that's the story I grew up with, and it really cemented in my mind this idea that you know, strange places have even stranger stories. And I think from a young age, I think I was drawn to you know, the weird and the kooky. And then as I got older and I, you know, got more interested in history, you know, I was driven more to understand, you know, both exactly what is the true story and also what was my own fascination in these things. Why was I so excited about these stories as a kid?
When you chose different places to spotlight in this book, what were your criteria?
You know, yeah, that was a fun process to do. I mean, part of it, I started, as you might, with Googling a lot of, you know, most haunted mansion, most haunted hotel, most haunted cemetery, you know, and I started to draw up some lists that way. I also tried as best I could to kind of spread it out throughout the country. I tried to sort of focus on the different parts of the United States, because my hypothesis, which turned out to be more or less true, was that different parts of the country will tell different kinds of ghost stories and will do so for different reasons. And so I tried to sort of spread it out that way. And then I think I was also looking for, you know, particularly distinctive or strange stories that had something new or unique to bring to the table. So it, you know, so it didn't just feel like a kind of litany of
and greatest hits.
House. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
now, I'm going to ask you a question now, and I'm going to ask you a follow-up at the end. Going into this, did you have a sense that most of these stories, if not all of them, were just kind of urban legend, lore, you know, fun stories to tell, but really probably not anything actually going on? Was that kind of your viewpoint going in? I don't want to put words in your mouth. What was your viewpoint in that regard going in?
I think my viewpoint going in was to really keep as best I could an open mind. And so, I, you know, we talked already about the story of the Winchester House. I mean, that's a story that I presumed to be true when I came in. I mean, whether or not actually I believed Sarah Winchester's family to be haunted by ghosts was one thing, but I could see how someone could come to believe that and might build a house, to keep them at bay. So I assumed that story was true when I would go to other places. You know, there's a famous house in New Orleans that was once owned by a woman named Delphine LaLaurie, who was so notorious for terrible things that went on in her house that your listeners probably know from the American Horror Story season that was somewhere based on her. You know, so I assumed not necessarily that she was an agent of Satan, but I assumed that, you know, she had probably done some really cruel and terrible things. And so I tried to go into these stories with somewhat of an open mind.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. We're going to actually talk about more specific places when we get back with our interview. Our guest today is Colin Dickey. His new book is Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. We'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast.
If you enjoy adult coloring books, check out the True Ghost Story adult coloring book inspired by Jim's Campfire podcast and books. Creepy coloring fun created by illustrator Len Peralta. Find it at Amazon, or for the direct links, go to jimharoldbooks.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast. The subject today is the new book, Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. Our guest is the author, Colin Dickey, and the book is doing very, very well, just released and perfect for this time of the year. Now, let's talk about some specific places, some specific regions. Do you find that there is or was one region of the country that tended to have more hauntings or more stories than other ones?
You know, I certainly expected that to be the case. I certainly figured that the East Coast, particularly New England, and maybe the Eastern Seaboard or the South would have kind of more ghosts per capita, just simply for the fact that, Americans, I guess, you know, European immigrants have been there longer, have had settlements and recorded history there in New England and in the South longer than, say, you know, California or the Midwest. So I thought that would be the case, but it turned out, again, as I plunged into the research, often that was not the case. I Los Angeles, which is a pretty new city, all things considered. I mean, you know, prior to the 1900s, very few people lived in Los Angeles, but Los Angeles probably has as many ghosts per capita as, Savannah, Georgia or Salem, Massachusetts. And so, it really turned out to be the case that it's such a widespread and ubiquitous, I think, facet of American culture that even places that aren't as old as, you know, say Boston or New Orleans, nonetheless have caught up in terms of the number of ghost stories that they've collected.
In the book, you talk about anatomy of a haunting. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so I wanted to start the book by kind of drilling down on one story in particular, and I thought that I'd sort of set the tone by really, you know, as the title implies, sort of doing a dissection of one story. So I looked at the Merchant's House Museum in New York, New York, and it's in Manhattan. It's in Lower Manhattan. It is a old brownstone that was built in the 1830s, and it is the oldest standing building that still has its original furniture, I think is their claim. But, you know, suffice to say, it's an old house. It's been a museum since the 1930s, and it's famous for its ghosts that people will regularly report, you know, taking a tour of the house, and a docent in period costume will show up and be, you know, claim to be one of the original family members who will sort of tell them stories about living in that house. And then they'll get downstairs to the gift shop and the staff will say, well, we don't have docents dressed in period costumes. So I thought, well, this is a good place to start, you know? And so I started there, and the story of the family, it was a sort of prosperous, middle-class merchant family. A guy by the name of Samuel Treadwell built the house for his family. His daughter, Gertrude Treadwell, was born, I believe, 1842 or something. She lived in the house her whole time, her whole life, died in her 90s, never married. Her brother was the scion intended to sort of inherit the family business, but was kind of a ne'er-do-well and thus sort of kind of became the black sheep of the family and so forth. And so I took all these stories and the stories of the hauntings, and I tried to sort of really understand, you know, here is a building that is anomalous. It doesn't fit in Manhattan. If you go to Lower Manhattan, it's all concrete and glass because they're tearing down everything they can to build, you know, multi-million dollar condos. And here's this old building that kind of sits by itself, even in the middle of all this bustle and hustle of the city. And I thought about these stories about, you know, the spinster woman who doesn't marry, who lives in the house, and then after she dies sort of stays on. And that's a very kind of common trope among haunted houses. You see it with Sarah Winchester. You see it kind of comes from the Charles Dickens novel Great Expectations with Miss Havisham. And, you know, so I sort of use this house to kind of talk about both the way in which certain kind of tropes and cliches of family life can be fodder for ghost stories, and also the way in which certain kind of buildings that don't quite fit in also become a repository for ghosts over the years.
If you had a list of conditions or ingredients to create a haunted house or a haunted prison or a haunted bar, haunted anything, what are kind of the ingredients where you kind of like, it's almost like a cocktail, you know, you put it in, you shake it up, and you've got a haunting. Did you find any consistencies along that line?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would say, you know, there are a couple of sort of architectural features that broadly speaking, I found in houses, I found in prisons, I found in hotels, I found in a lot of places, and it boils down to, you know, a construction that maybe feels a little bit off or a little bit strange. If you know the House of Seven Gables in Salem, Massachusetts, it's famous for, in addition to being the inspiration for Nathaniel Hawthorne's haunted house novel, it's also known for this hidden staircase in the middle of the house that's sort of right behind the fireplace. There's this little tiny door, and it opens up into this strange, bizarre staircase that kind of winds around the fireplace all the way to the attic, and for years nobody knew, you know, where it had come from, what was its purpose, who built it, you know, that was all kind of lost in mystery. So places like that, places that have unexplained architectural feature, those tend to get to attract haunted stories and ghost tales. So that's one thing. I mean, I think also simply a building that has outlived its purpose or its usefulness, but yet hasn't been torn down, is another thing that I kept seeing over and over again. So if you conjure to your mind a haunted insane asylum, for example, you sort of think of it, you just, you know, what do those words bring to mind? Probably brings to mind what's known as a Kirkbride Asylum, which is a particular floor plan designed by an architect named Thomas Kirkbride in the mid 19th century, and they dot the country all over the place. They're the Kirkbride Asylum has usually the big, tall Victorian clock tower out front,
right?
And the wings that spread out to either side, you know, kind of as far as the eye can see. So they build all of these Kirkbride, you know, asylums everywhere from, you know, Salem, Oregon to, you know, to Maine, and, you know, the Trans-Allegheny Haney Lunatic Asylum. That pronunciation, you know, those kind of things. You know, the Danvers Asylum in Salem, Massachusetts, that became H.P. Lovecraft's inspiration for Arkham Asylum and that kind of stuff. And what all those have in common is they were built for this kind of utopian ideal of psychiatry that gradually fell by the wayside, and yet they are way too big and too sturdy to just be torn down. I mean, you're talking about tens of thousands of square feet of brick and stone and concrete. And so these behemoths just sort of sit there after, you know, after the state moves its patients to a newer facility. They don't know what to do with a Kirkbride's asylum, so it just sits there on top of a hill, kind of looming menacingly. So that's another thing I kept finding, was these outdated buildings that yet were, one reason or another, you couldn't quite tear down or get rid of.
Well, it's interesting. The Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, I mentioned this on the show before, was near where my grandparents lived.
We
lived out of state, and we passed it every year. And at that point, it was still a functioning, it wasn't called that at the time. I think it was just called Weston State Hospital. And the thing was that it was a little more insensitive time, so we'd always make jokes about dropping off various members of the family and so forth. You know,
right.
But I guess the point is that, yeah, I mean, it was still functioning up to, you know, probably 20, 25 years ago. So
right.
It's amazing to think that these places abandoned now were still relatively recent.
Right, right. Yeah. And one of the people I interviewed in the book is an architect named Robert Kirkbride, who is a descendant of the original Thomas Kirkbride, and who is now very much involved in trying to preserve some of these buildings. And, you know, and he describes them as America's castles, which I thought was a great and evocative phrase. It sort of calls to mind the haunted castles of Europe. And, you know, since we don't have medieval castles here, obviously, you know, what we have are these gargantuan asylums, and some communities have been pretty good about transforming them into new and adaptive, you know, spaces, you know, office buildings or, you know, mall, shopping malls or apartments or something like that. So some places have been able to give them new life, so to speak. But there are other ones that, yeah, that are just more or less just kind of sitting, waiting for the wrecking ball. And in the meantime, you know, as you say, you drive by them, you don't know the story, you don't know, you know, exactly what goes on there. You've just heard rumors and so, you know, you start to tell ghost stories about them.
Now, in your section called The Unhomely, about houses and mansions, you have a rather ominous title for one of these. It's called The Family That Would Not Live in St. Louis, Missouri. Who was the family that would not live?
Yeah, you know, one of the things about ghost stories is you know, a lot of times you know they're spooky and they're strange. But one of the things I kept finding as I went through these is in a lot of cases the actual story behind the ghost tales is actually pretty sad and pretty tragic. And the Lemp family of St. Louis, Missouri is a pretty good example of this. The Lemp family was a brewing family in the mid 19th century. So they were the Lemp Brewery was a pretty strong rival to Anheuser-Busch and Pabst. Although the owners were friends with Pabst, but you know they were this big brewing behemoth that really helped sort of spread beer throughout, you know, America in the 19th century. And the what should have been a kind of rags to riches immigrant family from Germany makes it big and, you know, starts a legacy. Ended up quite sad when several of the Lemp family members over a course of about a 30-year period in the beginning of the 20th century, one by one, all committed suicide. First, the patriarch, William Lemp, committed suicide, and then eventually three of his children did. And three of these four suicides were actually in the Lemp mansion, which still stands in St. Louis, Missouri. And So certainly it's now considered quite haunted. You can take ghost tours there. You can stay there overnight and, you know, wander around with your, you know, your ghost hunting gadgets of various kinds. And and that's fine. And it's a pretty creepy, strange mansion. But what I couldn't shake, even as I was, you know, sort of reveling in these paranormal stories and whatnot, was this idea that, you know, perhaps here was a family that had some sort of undiagnosed depression or you know, some sort of, you know, medical issues that maybe now we would treat with, you know, medication or therapy or something like that. And because they didn't have access or didn't want access to that, instead kind of gave themselves over to these private demons, and the result being that we've taken, you know, what might otherwise be a kind of just kind of sad tragedy, and we've turned it into this spooky ghost story. And now you can buy in the gift shop, you can buy a board game, the Haunted Lemp Mansion board game, where you try and get out of the house before the, you know, before you literally commit suicide. So it's sort of a garish sort of way of taking that tragedy and kind of making, you know, light of it, which I thought was kind of strange.
Well, on that point, you know, a lot of people like to go out and ghost hunt and do things like that. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. In fact, we've got a lot of those people listen to these programs. But I always like to remind people, especially when you're dealing with death or tragedy or things, I mean, even if you don't believe in any of this stuff, these were real people who had real struggles. And I think we should also always try to be somewhat cognizant of that. And then the second piece is that if you do believe in this stuff, it pays to be sensitive to ghosts too, because I guess, I'm sure somebody's written a book by this title, Ghosts Are People Too. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, kind of, the line between being interested in the stuff and having fun and exploring it and crossing the line and maybe being a little bit insensitive to those who have passed before and maybe still maybe hanging around.
Yeah. I mean, certainly like you, I mean, I love a good ghost story. I love the dark and the mysterious. I love the tragedy and the weirdness. I've been on ghost hunts. I've been on more ghost tours than I care to count, you know, and I agree with you. There's a lot of fun there. And most of it's harmless. And I support all that. I think you're right, though, that sometimes the story may be closer to living memory than I think that we maybe give it credit for. And one of the stories that I looked at in the book was in Portland, Oregon. There is a bridge, the St. John's Bridge, which is this beautiful kind of green copper Gothic bridge, and beneath it is this park that is supposedly haunted by the ghost of a woman who was murdered there. And and so kids go there all the time looking for the ghost of this young woman. But what many people don't realize is that that woman, who she was 16 when she was murdered, and it was 1949 she was abducted and murdered. Members of her family are still alive, including her sister, who was only 4 years old, I think, at the time that her older sister was murdered. And so I try in the book to sort of suggest, there's nothing wrong with ghost hunting. There's nothing wrong with having fun. There's nothing wrong with getting into that. But, give a thought to the people for whom this tragedy might actually still be a part of their daily lives and something that they actually, still live with. So that's one thing. But I think, the flip side of that is also, several of the ghost hunters that I talk to, and when I would bring that up, they would say, well, this is also a way of keeping those memories alive. This is a way of engaging with the past. And I guess that's another kind of fascinating aspect, is that, it is often through these ghost stories that we do get to sort of commemorate these tragedies and memorialize things that might otherwise fall by the wayside. So I guess it's a double-edged sword, I guess you could say.
We talked a little bit about asylums. You have one story here, and it's interesting. You have some stories in here that have, looks like, multiple locations. And I was fascinated by this title, Awaiting the Devil's Coming.
Yeah. So when I was trying to sort of get my short list of places to visit, a friend of mine mentioned the Stoll Cemetery in Stoll County, or I guess it's Douglas County, the town of Stoll, Douglas County, Kansas. And she said, yes, you should check out the Stoll Cemetery. And then she said, although beware, because you're not going to be attacked by ghosts or demons, but you may be attacked by the locals. and the story is Stoll Cemetery is a pretty innocuous, otherwise ordinary little cemetery in this little tiny town, but it happens to be nearby the University of Kansas. It's about 15 miles from Lawrence, Kansas. And over the years, the students of the University of Kansas have decided that this is a particularly demonic cemetery. There's supposedly a gate to hell buried somewhere there. And so every year on Halloween, for many years, the students of University of Kansas would descend on this nice little cemetery and more or less get drunk and terrorize it. And so the real spirits of the Stoll Cemetery are in fact not paranormal. They are the spirits that come out of bottles. But so every year the students would go and they would wait. The chapter title comes from the story that at some point in the 19th century the devil impregnated a human woman who gave birth to his child, and the child was murdered by the townspeople to prevent the devil from, doing what devils do. And so the child of Satan is actually buried in the Stoll Cemetery. And that's why every year the devil returns to pay respects to his dead son. And so that's what ostensibly the kids are there to do. But, after a while, the sheriff basically had to put out in full force there every night or every year on Halloween to keep the kids away. And I think now it's finally died down a bit.
I mean, you have several sections in this book: the unhomely houses and mansions, after hours, bars, restaurants, hotels, and brothels, civic minded spirits and useless memory. And it's varied. We definitely can't hit all these stories today. That's why people need to pick up the book. But is there one place that freaked you out, that you kind of went in with kind of the academic mindset and you came out and said, wow, that that was pretty freaky.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, this book really crystallized for me when my wife and I were looking for a house to buy in Los Angeles. And if any of your readers know Los Angeles, in East Hollywood, there's a lot of little communities, Los Feliz, Silver Lake, and Echo Park, and those places that are kind of little neighborhoods in Los Angeles. And they're filled with these old bungalows that were all built in the 20s and 30s for movie production, you know, housing. And over the years, people have gradually enlarged them sort of here and there, kind of willy-nilly, you know, a lot of this unpermitted sort of DIY additions. And so we looked at a lot of these homes that you could see, you know, in 1925 when it was first built, it was just a cute little bungalow, but now it had, you know, a second floor sort of haphazardly added or sort of a weird architectural detail, you know. And after a while, these all started to feel a little strange, but there was one in particular, because we gave them all nicknames just to keep them straight when we would talk about, you know, what we'd seen. And, you know, we had the flea house where a flea had bit our realtor. We had
that's not a good sign.
No, none of these names were particularly flattering. You know, we had the burn house, which was one that just had this sort of inexplicable charred mark on the wall, which could have been Satan for all we know. But then there was the house that we took to calling the Happy Murder Castle. And the Happy Murder Castle was by far the strangest and most unsettling home I've ever been in. And it was up the street from an elementary school. And so we think it might have been a daycare, you know, maybe unlicensed at one point, because part of the house was covered in that kind of like faux flagstone, like painted on, like it was an old castle.
Right.
You know, one of the bedrooms actually had the little crenellated detail on it, you know, the little, like those little spikes you see on castle turrets, you know, so it was meant sort of to look like a castle, but then it also looked clearly like an old, you know, 1920s bungalow. And sort of the two of them kind of like were kind of joined uneasily without real rhyme or reason. And and we wandered through this most bizarre place, you know, rooms that were sort of too small to be rooms, but too wide to be hallways. There was a door into the backyard that went from the bedroom into the bathroom, which it's sort of a strange, you know, like you don't think of like going through the bathroom on your way to the backyard, but that was the only way to get into the backyard. And as we were leaving, our realtor, you know, kind of grabbed us and said, "Hey, you guys," and she pointed to the wall, and somebody had written on the wall in pencil, "A murderer lived here."
Ooh.
You know, and it was, I mean, it's just sort of like, kind of, you've been in this house for 10, 15 minutes looking around, and all of a sudden you see this thing, and it's just sort of, you know, kind of like grabbed us. And, you know, I never quite figured out the exact story, but I, you know, I tried to kind of make sense a little bit of what I saw when I wrote the book.
So at the beginning of the show, we asked you, you know, what was your mindset going into all of this? And you mentioned that you were very open-minded. You were trying to go in without judgment. What was your determination at the end of it? Do you feel that you could say that, yeah, these are mainly urban legends and not a real lot to them? Or do you feel now, wow, there's more to this stuff than even I ever thought?
Yeah, you know, as you said, I went in feeling that I was going to be open-minded about these stories. And in a lot of cases, I was surprised to find out that you know, say nothing of the paranormal aspects, the actual history that is often given on a tour or repeated in a guidebook or that you'll find on the web, the actual history itself is often very wrong or distorted or adjusted or fabricated in some way, shape, or form. And I found that to be a really fascinating thing, that for a lot of people, ghost hunting and ghost stories are a way to access our own history and our own past and sort of understand, you know, what happened in a place, you know, to quote the Hitchcock film Vertigo, who shot who in the Embarcadero in 1873, you know, that's what we go to ghost stories for. And those stories are often, often not the real story. And I found that to be, you know, a sort of fascinating in its own right, but it then begged the question, you know, why do we adjust the true story for these slightly fabricated ghost stories, and what is the purpose of those stories? And it seems that the stories that we tell are doing a lot of sort of interesting cultural legwork for us as communities, both locally and nationally. That these stories seem to fill out needs that we have and engage us in important ways. And I thought that was really fascinating, even if it meant that a lot of things weren't actually true.
Well, it's been a great conversation. Most importantly, and I guess the answer is probably pretty much everywhere, because this is a major release from a major publisher, where can people find the book?
Yeah, they should be able to find it. I mean, certainly on online outlets or at their local bookstores. Hopefully it's an easy grasp.
Well, the book to grasp is Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. Our guest today has been Colin Dickey. Colin, thank you for joining us.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me on. This has been a great conversation.
And thank you for tuning in to the Paranormal Podcast. We certainly appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next time. Stay spooky. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.